Put your hand on our shoulder and point us in the right direction. Put our hands on someone's shoulder and let it matter. Amen. Tuesday concluded the two-year marathon of selecting a new president, the longest job interview for what is probably the most powerful position in the world. After the results came in, so close in the popular vote, less close in the Electoral College, roughly 60.9 million of us voting for one candidate and roughly 60.3 million of us voting for the other, at least according to this morning's tally, we began the process of picking ourselves up as a country and dealing with the aftershocks. One Boston Globe article said that America looks exhausted now that it's over. We've all heard stories of 1960s and 70s style political marches and rallies and protests throughout the country, even here in Ithaca and at Cornell on Friday. Some students in your classes were crushed by Tuesday's result, while others quietly celebrated. The pundit class has spilled pools of ink over the past few days, some wagging their fingers, saying, "I told you so," and others wondering how this could have happened, printing headlines with phrases like "moment of reckoning" and "electoral earthquake." For many of us, the results are so shocking and embittering that it's like we've lost a loved one, and we've been moving this week through the stages of grief, first denial, then anger, then bargaining. What if this or that had happened instead? If only this or that had happened. Then the depression stage that slowly gives way to acceptance. Some of us may not have reached that final stage yet, and that's okay. Others of us may be just plain afraid of what's coming after Inauguration Day on January 20th, afraid for our families, our children and grandchildren, afraid for our planet. Afraid for immigrants and refugees, Muslims and women, people of color and gay folks. One self-identified queer writer described his feeling this week as one of, quote, sheer terror. No matter how you voted on Tuesday, we have an opportunity as a UCC church with a rainbow flag on our front lawn to throw open our doors even wider to society's others. They may need the progressive Christian church now more than ever, need to know that this space is safe for them, that it is a shelter from the storm, as Dylan once sang. I last referred to shelter from the storm in my sermon on the anniversary of 9/11, and it just feels right to refer to Dylan again after this week's events. We've had our chapel open all week for people to come in and pray. And on Wednesday, our denomination, the United Church of Christ, published a pastoral letter to provide some guidance as we move forward. Part of that letter reads as follows. Dear United Church of Christ, we were built to heal bodies broken and divided. This is our calling. Our core values of love, hospitality, and justice must be fully embraced in the days to come. It could well be that we were called into being for just such a time as this. That last phrase comes from the biblical book of Esther. As I prepared this sermon, I marveled at how well today's lectionary readings from the Bible, the lectionary is that three-year cycle of texts that we follow in this church, how well today's readings capture the mood of the week. In the section before today's Hebrew Bible reading from Isaiah, the prophet is baffled and wonders aloud with words some of us may have uttered this week, what just happened? Isaiah is speaking to the ancient Israelites who were trying to pick themselves up after a national tragedy, after exile, when their political rulers had failed them, their society had collapsed, and they were wondering, what's next? In today's gospel reading, Luke's Jesus channels the emotion of fear. Luke presents Jesus as an apocalyptic prophet Much like an ancient Hebrew prophet, a prophet who scans the horizon and sees a political and social wasteland. As Luke tells it, Jesus is milling about in the temple in Jerusalem when he overhears people extolling the structure's large and beautiful stones. Archaeologists have found stones in the temple's walls that weigh more than 80 tons, cut, transported, trimmed, lifted, and fitted into place by hand long before the age of mechanized cranes. The largest stone of the ancient Jerusalem temple is in the foundation of the western wall. It weighs 570 tons and is 45 feet long by 13 feet wide, also moved and fitted into place by hand. As the people celebrate the size and precision of the temple's stones, and eavesdropping Jesus reigns on their parade and prophesies that those same stones would all be pulled down, a reference to the Roman army, which did indeed topple the temple in the year 70. Jesus wasn't the only mid-first century Jew predicting the fall of the temple. There were others who knew the revolutionary spirit in first century Jerusalem would eventually provoke the Romans. But Luke's Jesus goes further, and he worries that political events in his day might lead to an apocalypse, that society itself might come undone, accompanied, he says, by conflict and war, persecution, natural disasters, famines, plagues, and great signs from heaven. Ominous words that might resonate with some of you after the election. Isaiah is baffled. Luke's Jesus channels fear, emotions many of us may have felt this week. One of the things I love most about the Bible, as weird and freakish as it can be sometimes, is that it contains within its pages millennia of human experiences. It's a vast repository, a library's worth of stories about the human experience. And it doesn't mince words when naming our emotions. It tells us it's okay to be baffled by world events. It tells us that it's okay to feel, as Dylan sings in Shelter from the Storm, hopeless and forlorn. It's okay to be outraged and afraid, uncertain, cautious, and even cautiously optimistic. It's even okay to worry about the apocalypse, as Jesus once did. But the beauty of the Bible is that it never leaves us in the valley. It's filled with stories and poems and songs penned by people who hunted for hope. Moses spotted a way forward through the wilderness for his people. Joseph, enslaved in Egypt, looked for the hand of God in his life. Jeremiah sung of a new pact between God and the people after the horrors of exile. Job, in the midst of unbearable suffering, still had the wherewithal to fight with God. St. Paul likened the spiritual journey to a race that we all can win, regardless of how many twists and turns there are on the track. The writer of Revelation, the Bible's scariest text, foresees that humanity will someday be a sea of tranquility. Isaiah, in today's Hebrew Bible reading, promises that God is working even now to recreate, to refashion like a tireless potter at the wheel, beginning again to shape the clay of this world to realize a dream of harmony, symbolized by a wolf and a lamb grazing together. And Luke's Jesus in today's gospel reading pivots from apocalyptic prophet to gentle pastor and offers words of hope. No matter what happens in the world, he says, not a hair of your head will be truly harmed because you are a child of God and nothing can change that. Many people hunted for hope this week to help us all heal. On Wednesday, comedian Ellen DeGeneres said, "People have been very passionate about this race, and I think it's because we all love our country. We just have different ideas about what's best for it, which is part of what makes America great." She continued, "If you take away the labels, you realize we are far more alike than we are different." Her audience cheered, and then she wove in some humor. We are far more alike, she says. For instance, no matter what your politics are, we all have that feeling of stepping out of the shower and realizing that the towel is on the other side of the bathroom and you have to tiptoe across the floor so you don't drip too much. Or we all do that thing, she says, when you pull into a parking garage and you duck your head to make sure you make it. And it doesn't matter if you're liberal or conservative, we've all passed out watching Netflix and woke up not knowing what episode we're on or what season we're in. We have so much in common, our differences actually make us stronger, she says. But here's where I make the exception. The people who leave the shopping carts in the middle of the parking spot at the grocery store. Other people try to pick up the pieces after the election by offering advice. One college student at Kansas State University sounded like an ancient Stoic philosopher when he said in an interview, "I don't know how things are going to turn out over the next 4 years, but I just know for me, I have to control what I can control." That's almost word for word what the ancient Stoic philosopher Epictetus once wrote. Maybe that student was a classics major. One article online had 7 tips for embarking on a spiritual recovery after the election. Another had 10 tips. Religious leaders have written pastoral letters. I listened to Dylan's Shelter from the Storm on a loop this week. On Twitter, hashtag #cheermeupin3words was filled with good advice. Count your blessings, said one tweet. Change the world, said another, below a picture of Martin Luther King Jr. Don't be scared, said another. You're never alone, said another. Eat more bacon, said another. But I want to close today by sharing 2 of the most powerful messages of healing that I found on social media this week. The first is by people who've been posting pictures of themselves with safety pins over their hearts. Regardless of a person's politics, displaying the safety pin has symbolic value for the most vulnerable of our society. One Facebook post explained it this way. A person wearing or displaying a safety pin welcomes you, no matter what you look like, who you love, whatever your origins, however you worship. The safety pin trend began in the UK after the Brexit vote and the outbreak of xenophobic attacks. The Southern Poverty Law Center reported that as of Friday, there were 200 election-related incidents of harassment and intimidation in the U.S. In response, Molly Basquette, senior minister of the Berkeley UCC Church, posted a devotional that included these powerful words about the safety pin movement. If you wear a hijab, I'll sit with you on the train. If you're trans, I'll go with you to the bathroom. If you're a person of color, I'll stand with you if the cops stop you. If you're a person with disabilities, I'll hand you my megaphone. If you're an immigrant, I'll help you find resources. If you're a survivor, I'll believe you. If you're a refugee, I'll make sure you're welcome. If you're a veteran, I'll take up your fight. If you're LGBTQ, I'll remind you that you are beautiful and beloved, just as God made you. If you're a woman, I'll make sure you get home okay. If you're tired, me too. If you need a hug, I have an infinite supply. If you need me, I'll be with you. All I ask is that you be with me too, and together we'll be the strong arm of God. That sounds to me like a first step toward making Jesus' promise come true that not a hair of your head will be harmed. The second message of hope came up on my Twitter feed. It's a story about eating together by David Brooks, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Here's what he writes. Kathy Fletcher and David Simpson have a son named Santi who went to Washington, D.C. public schools. Santi had a friend who sometimes went to school hungry. So Santi invited him to occasionally eat and sleep at his house. That friend had a friend, and that friend had a friend. And now when you go to dinner at Kathy and David's house on Thursday night, there might be 15 to 20 teenagers crammed around the table, and later there will be groups of them crashing in the basement or in the few small bedrooms upstairs. The kids who show up at Kathy and David's have endured the ordeals of modern poverty, homelessness, hunger, abuse, assault. Almost all have seen death firsthand to a sibling, a friend, even a parent. One 21-year-old woman came to dinner last week and said this was the first time she'd been around a family table since she was 11. Thursday dinner is the big social occasion of the week. Kids come from around the city. Spicy chicken and black rice are served. Cell phones are banned. The kids call Kathy and David Mama and Dad, are unfailingly polite, clear the dishes, turn toward one another's love like plants toward the sun, and burst with big, glowing personalities. Birthdays and graduations are celebrated. Songs are performed. Brooks continues, I started going to dinner there about 2 years ago, hungry for something beyond food. Each meal we go around the table, and everybody has to say something nobody else knows about them. Each meal we demonstrate our commitment to care for one another. I took my daughter once, and on the way out, she said, that's the warmest place I could ever imagine. During this election cycle of viciousness, vulgarity, and depravity, Brooks continues, Thursdays at Kathy and David's have been a weekly uplift, and their home a place to be reminded of what is beautiful about our country and what we can do to bring out its loveliness. And that story sounds to me like a modern example of Isaiah's vision of harmony and healing. I soothed campaign wounds yesterday by waking early and working on my sermon, but then cooking breakfast with my kids. We put on the Harry Potter soundtrack from iTunes because it's comforting, and we made pancakes, bacon, and eggs, and talked and laughed and brought mommy breakfast in bed. None of us knows what the future will hold. But those stories about safety pins and sacred meals remind us that healing is always possible, that it begins by focusing on our closest relationships, spending more quality time with our family and friends, contributing to the life of our church community, mending relations with that conservative brother-in-law or that liberal aunt, asking forgiveness if it's called for. And then as a church, let's open our doors wider to those who are the most vulnerable and the most terrified. Let's display our rainbows and our safety pins, and let's share our food. Because in doing these things, I think we realize those ancient words of hope from Jesus about keeping even the hair on our heads safe. And that ancient dream from Isaiah that God is working even now to mend and to heal. And maybe, just maybe, in our lifetimes, we'll see wolves and lamb dwelling in peace. Amen.